Support for this podcast comes from The Huntington, presenting Toni Stone, Play Ball. Witness the remarkable true story of the first woman to play professional baseball on a man's team, shattering expectations and creating her own set of rules. Now through June 16th at The Huntington Theater, huntingtontheater.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. UN Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix delivered his much-anticipated report on Iraqi compliance to the Security Council today, and in it, there was something for everyone. Tough talk on Iraq's reluctant cooperation, sure to give the White House material for tough talk on war. And strong support for the inspection's process. Just what Europe wants to hear. The powers will take away what they want from the Blix brief. In the words of Mohammed El-Baradei, U.S. troops are circling Iraq. France, Germany, Russia, and China. I'm sorry, France, Russia, and China hold Security Council veto cards. So is a Washington-led war still on the way? Will the U.S. go to war without a U.N. resolution? And did today's report give you grounds for hope or fear? At this point, what are you hoping for? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin tonight with the latest from the United Nations. Joining us from New York is Colm Lynch, staff writer for The Washington Post. Good evening and welcome, Colm.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Good to hear from you.
Very well. It's great to have you. Colm Lynch, quite a day, tons of cameras and microphones focused on the Security Council chamber this morning. Give us the aftermath. What's been the response to Hans Blix's presentation?
Well, the response so far, I mean, is, as you mentioned a minute ago to your listeners, I mean, basically, nothing that was said in this meeting altered the view of any of the key Security Council members. The Americans and the British are still pushing for a hard line on Iraq. Either, you know, Iraq turns around immediately, dramatically changes its attitude about inspections, really opens its doors and gives away everything that the Americans believe that they have, then they're talking about war in Iraq. And the rest of the council members, as you mentioned, they don't want a war, and they're going to do whatever they can to keep this process going. They're sort of taking heart and hearing that, you know, the inspections have produced some new information about chemical warheads found in Iraq and that sort of thing. So they're basically arguing that we need to keep this process going.
Colm Lynch, let's get right down to the heart of things here. Does Washington appear to be prepared to wait for some further period to invest more time and seriousness in weapons inspection?
Yeah, the administration has been indicating over the last couple of days that they were willing to give this process another couple of weeks, a few weeks, but not months. So there is going to be another briefing of the council on February 14th. This is going to be another opportunity for the inspectors to tell the council how the inspections are going. If there are further problems, further sort of acts of obstruction, this will certainly build the American case. But we're really talking about weeks and not about months.
And watching the Security Council with the intimacy that you do, do you see any way that the United States will come out of the Security Council with approval for armed action for war against Iraq?
It's a really tough call right now. It doesn't look like it immediately, but at the same time, the administration hasn't really started to twist arms. It hasn't started to call heads of states and, you know, pleaded, begged, and or demanded that they support a resolution of the council.
But it only has a matter of weeks now, as you say.
Yeah, but nobody's even presented a resolution before the council at this point. So if a resolution does come before the council, then the Americans are going to have to move very, very quickly. But at this point, it certainly doesn't look good. I mean, it looks like it's going to require a lot of work, and as you say, there isn't a lot of time.
It would be a long climb down for the Europeans, for most of them, from the positions they've staked out in the last month.
Yeah, it would certainly be for the Germans. I mean, the French have always left their options open, always sort of indicated that there is the possibility that they may even join in some sort of military action. But they made it clear today, and they have over the last couple of days, that this process should play out for another couple of months at the least, and that they would, at least in the short term, they have suggested that are even considering using their veto to block any sort of war resolution coming out of the council.
So, Colm Lynch, have we come to the kind of break point that President Bush threatened the UN with last fall? He said, if you're not willing to step up At the end of this, we'll go it alone, and that will be a great black mark on the UN. I'm sure other Security Council members might not see it that way, but are we at some kind of potential breakpoint where the UN is seen to be ineffective, or at least so far from cohesion that it's not a serious council for dealing with this kind of issue?
Well, we're not there yet, but we could be there very closely. And this all really depends on at what point the United States decides that it no longer wants to engage in this process, that when it decides that the council has sort of exhausted its usefulness and decides to go it alone. At that point, they will probably give everybody an opportunity to sign on. They'd be perfectly happy to have the council pass a resolution that increases their legitimacy, but they have been making it increasingly clear that they would do it without that resolution. So I think it's coming up possibly in the next within the next month, maybe a little bit longer.
Colm, how deep is the apprehension on the Security Council about the implications of all this for the United Nations itself?
It's very serious. I mean, you keep hearing, particularly from the Secretary General, from Kofi Annan, one of the things that he keeps repeating every time he gets in front of a camera is sort of appealing to the Council that whatever you do, preserve the unity of the Council. If you don't stick together, not only will it ease pressure on Iraq to disarm peacefully, but that it could have long-term damage on the legitimacy and the credibility of the Security Council and the credibility of the United Nations at large.
Colm Lynch, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
All right. Thanks for having me. Talk to you later.
Talk to you later. Colm Lynch is staff writer for The Washington Post. He covers the United Nations in New York. Joining us now from Washington is Terrence Taylor, U.S. Executive Director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He was also Chief Inspector for the U.N. Weapons Inspections in Iraq from 1993 to 1997. Good evening and welcome, Terrence Taylor.
Good evening. I was one of the chief inspectors, not the chief inspector.
All right. Duly noted. But there you were in the thick of it, and today you, like the rest of us, watched and heard, no doubt, Hans Blix give his report before the Security Council. What did you make of it?
Well, I suppose I'm giving a technical comment here, not a political one. And so I find it very disappointing. For me, it was deja vu. The Iraqis, as Dr. Hans Blix made clear, cooperating in the sense of allowing access and being quite good and on procedures and so on, with some difficulty, which I might like to come back to in a moment, mm-hmm. but delivering nothing on substance, no new information, only giving information that the inspectors already knew, and even in some areas falling short. So just as a purely technical comment, I would say I was disappointed and surprised, actually, that the Iraqis, with all the pressure, haven't delivered up something better than they've done already.
In spite of that, Hans Blix was in demeanor still patient, still ready to go along with the process, even though he had quite critical things to say about the substance of what has been delivered. How do you interpret that? Is that just Hans Blix being a good diplomat?
No, he is a good diplomat. He's a consummate diplomat, and so he should be. I mean, but you have to remember that he's the head of an inspection mission, and I think what he said was a very tough statement. I was encouraged by that. He was very clear. He gave credit where it was due, and he certainly didn't pull his punches on where the Iraqis' shortcomings were. I think he's very clear about that. So I think he gave a very tough and professional job. And, of course, he's head of the inspection team. He doesn't decide on matters of peace and war. That's a political decision for members of the Security Council to make of his report, and he's inevitably going to ask for more time. One thing I should mention is he made clear that only very recently have the inspection teams got all the resources and all their bits and pieces, helicopters and so on, in order to be more comprehensive and intensive in their inspections. Mm. So you have to remember that the first two-thirds of the 60 days were you know, not at full capacity, one might say.
So, Terrence Taylor, let's get to the bottom line here. Washington and much of Europe are now at odds over the utility of these inspections. Colin Powell over the weekend essentially saying, we expect nothing from these, and we are ready to go to war. A number of nations in Europe still standing up strong for the inspections. What's your view? Is there value in going on with the inspections?
Well, of course, I think there is value in proceeding with the process, because what we're engaged in here is a negotiation. The UN Security Council is going to have a couple of closed sessions this week on Wednesday and on Friday, and clearly the Security Council members are going to have a very intensive debate about what to do next. The UN Security Council Resolution 1441 didn't set a time limit on the inspections, so somebody has to do something to stop them, and I don't think that's happening yet. The thing I would say, and this is at the heart of, I think, the statement by Colin Powell, and indeed by Hans Blix as well, and Mohammed Al-Baraidi, who mustn't forget the International Atomic Energy Agency as well, is that unless the Iraqis come forward and deliver new information, the inspectors could be there for years. This is the point. This is what happened in the 1990s. I was engaged with a very dedicated group of people in trying to find the Iraqi biological weapons program in the 1990s. It took us 4.5 years.
And what are you suggesting by that, Terence Taylor? That in fact we should be prepared to gird our inspection belts and stay for 4 or 5 years? Or, as the Colin Powell seemed to be suggesting, that's a farce, that's a waste?
Well, we shouldn't be allowed to drift into the situation of the 1990s, because what the Iraqi regime is hoping for is for the political will to erode and for the efforts and the military pressure to be diluted and so on, so they can survive and continue, because their real objective is regime survival. And I think that would be unfortunate, and it would be a failure on the part of the UN Security Council.
So do I hear you coming down for war, Terence Taylor, or does that overinterpret?
I think that's overinterpreting it. And as a military man and who's been engaged in military operations, I'm not an advocate of war. I think it should be avoided at all costs. But I think we need to point the finger where it should be pointed. The way to avoid war, the essence lies in Baghdad. And they need to change their policy, which is what essentially Dr. Hans Blix made very clear. And I think that's what needs to happen. I was very interested in the deliberations of a group of neighboring countries to Iraq, the Egyptians, the Syrians, the Turks, gathered together, and I think also Jordanians. And their statement was very interesting. They didn't point the finger at Washington or London. They pointed the finger at Baghdad and said, look, you have to comply with your obligations, Baghdad. And if you don't, then perhaps you should step aside.
But Terence Taylor, that's all well and good, but Saddam Hussein has shown himself to be very good at playing chicken. We've got 150,000 U.S. troops en route to Iraq and its environs now. The inspectors have been there for 60 days. They're not getting that substantial cooperation, as Hans Blix says. What's to make Iraq blink here if they're not blinking now?
Well, what it needs is a unified voice from the UN Security Council. And if, like the neighboring countries to Iraq, everybody pointed the finger at Baghdad instead of trying to rein in Washington, which seems to be the purpose of some of the European members of the UN Security Council, I think we'd get a better result from Baghdad, because if they were faced with no alternative with a single voice, I think that would change things in Baghdad. I think, unfortunately, the kind of political machinations that are going on are sending mixed messages to Baghdad and probably make war more likely.
Terence Taylor, stand by. Our news analyst Jack Beattie has been listening in from Hanover, New Hampshire. Good evening and welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Jack, you're listening right along with us here. Terence Taylor is saying, if we only had a unified voice, Baghdad would have to get the message. But we look a long way from a unified voice or view coming out of the meeting today.
Well, we certainly do, and even the British Prime Minister, according to newspaper reports today, he has laid down his conditions for war, and one of them is that the inspectors have to flat out say there is non-cooperation. And two, this is war outside of the Security Council resolution, and two, he will only do it if a Security Council member unreasonably vetoes a proposal to use force. That's a new condition, it seems to me, but I really think our listeners should look at a website that we're going to have on our website. This is prepared by a Glenn Rangwala, an Iraqi analyst at Cambridge University, cited today in the Financial Times. He cites many examples where the claims that the British and the United States have made about places in Iraq have not been borne out by subsequent inspections.
You mean claims of weapons or weapons manufacturing? manufacture.
For example, last September 7th, Mr. Bush cited satellite photos of a rebuilding activity at an Al-Furat and Tuatha nuclear facilities as evidence of new nuclear programs. On January 9th, Mr. El-Baradei reported no evidence of ongoing prohibited nuclear or nuclear-related activities has been detected. At another plant, the Department of Defense said was currently active nuclear in October. The Sydney Herald correspondent found, quote, a near-vacant lot. Mr. Bush spoke in his U.N. speech about Iraq's attempt to import aluminum tubes, quote, needed for gas centrifuges to enrich uranium. Mr. El-Baradei today says those are not suitable for centrifuge used instead of for rockets. Well, and I can go on and on and on.
There's the voice of doubt. Check out the website at onpointradio.org. Terrence Taylor, stick with us. Jack Beatty, we're talking about Hans Blix, the inspections, and the roads toward and away from war. Blix has spoken. Are you ready for war or for more inspections? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the UN Weapons Inspectors Report and the prospects of war. Washington wasted no time rolling out its responses to the Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei reports. Even Washington's most dovish statesman, Secretary of State Colin Powell, said today that Iraq is running out of time.
The issue is not how much more time the inspectors need to search in the dark. It is how much more time Iraq should be given to turn on the lights and to come clean. And the answer is not much more time. Iraq's time for choosing peaceful disarmament is fast coming to an end.
Secretary of State Colin Powell speaking this afternoon from the State Department. What do you think? If the U.S. and Europe cannot agree, should the United States make war anyway? Should the U.S. proceed to war without a U.N. blessing? And is the U.S. too eager for war? Or Europe too hesitant? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by Terrence Taylor, Executive Director of the U.S. Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He was a Chief Weapons Inspector in Iraq from 1993 to 1997. We're joined now as well by Gerard Baker, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Good evening and welcome, Gerard Baker.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. You've no doubt been watching the rift between Washington and the U.K. and much of the rest of Europe. How bad is it, Gerard Baker?
Well, on the surface, it looks as bad as it's been in a while. We had last week, of course, France and Germany making a very big show, a very big demonstration of their unity in opposing any prospect of immediate or early military action. Mm-hmm. And Britain, of course, has sided very firmly with the United States in supporting, if necessary, early military action and is basically reading from the same card as the United States. I think that the appearance, I stress the appearance because I'm not absolutely yet convinced that we are quite at the point where there is a kind of an irrevocable split. I think we should be careful to distinguish between different types of European opinion. The Germans have made very clear, absolutely from day one, and they reinforced that last week, that they have no intention whatsoever of voting for military force. And mm-hmm. in a sense, they don't really matter. I mean, they've actually put themselves out of the equation.
And they have no veto.
Yeah, they have no veto. Exactly, that's right. Even though next month they hold a rotating chairmanship at the Security Council, the French, however, do matter, and they have a veto, and they also, however, have a strong desire not to. I mean, they're great concern. The French, they have two concerns. One, public opinion at home is deeply hostile to war, and two, obviously, they're concerned about their own relations with the Arab world if they were to support a war. Against that, however, they have an even bigger. The one thing that they probably fear even more than a war going ahead, and causing all kinds of trouble, is a war going ahead and being prosecuted successfully without the French being involved.
I mean, on the winning side.
The one thing they're terrified about is irrelevance. And so it's not yet out of the question. I think the reason we're seeing this talk, if we have in the last few days, of another month or so, perhaps, for the inspections, is a final attempt to get the French on board. And I still wouldn't rule out the possibility that they will come on board.
And if we pull away all the talk about inspections, of course, we all know that that additional month is basically all the time that's left before Washington thinks it has to hit the button for war if it wants to go before the summer heat. What series of events, in your mind, Gerard Baker, could bring France at least around to the U.S. position or something close enough within that month or 6 weeks that's left before the Pentagon will say it's time to go?
What we had today was a start, I think, in that direction. There was no question that the report, particularly the Blix report, unless the report from the head of the IAEA, Mohamed Al-Baradei, but the Hans Blix report was much was pretty tough, actually, and was pretty clear in stating that up till now, Iraq has not cooperated as it is required to do.
He said still no genuine acceptance, not even today, of the disarmament that was demanded of it.
That's right, exactly. Now, you know, as you had just had a clip there from Colin Powell saying, how long can this go on? And I think the answer, the sensible answer that anyone would have to provide to that is it can't go on. It cannot go on indefinitely. And I think even the French accept that. So I think there is. So what's necessary now is to establish absolute conditions that would represent Iraqi compliance or non-compliance in the next month or so. The Saddam Hussein, absolutely, it's possible, I think, to construct a set of requirements that Saddam has to meet in the next month or 6 weeks, which if he doesn't meet, it's quite possible the French will be persuaded that he genuinely is just not going to comply and will give them crucially, give the French government crucially the political cover it needs to be able to say to its people, look, we don't want war. We know you don't want war. We've done our very, very level best to try and avoid war, but the truth is, this guy is just, I'm afraid the Americans are in the end right, this guy is just not cooperating, and I'm afraid we've got to deal with it. That seems to be, so the critical thing to look for in the next week, week to 10 days, is whether is what exactly the Security Council now requires in the next month Iraq to do, and whether or not, of course, beyond that, whether or not Iraq actually does comply. And if it doesn't comply, I think the chances are reasonable that France will in the end, certainly not oppose war and may even support it.
And yet, Terence Taylor, we know this is not all just big power tit for tat. There is a bona fide real argument against this war. Is that going to be lost as everything rolls ahead here, post Hans Blix's 60-day report?
Well, we're not obviously quite there yet, but I have a job with the argument against dealing with this, if necessary, by military means. I mean, Iraq has been repeatedly a material breach of the Security Council resolutions ever since 1991. And it's possible now, one thing I would have thought, and perhaps the United States may press with this in the UK, is at least they could make a common statement about Iraq and being in material breach without saying what they're going to do about it, leaving members free to decide what they're going to do about it.
But Jack Straw seemed to be leaning the other way today, at least in terms of going to war without UN blessing. He said, yes, it's a farce what's going on, but he said the continuation of the searches was up to the UN Security Council, not to any one state, a pretty barbed comment toward Washington, it would appear.
Well, I think, however, that despite that statement, I think the British, I think, are very keen for the inspection to continue right now, to allow negotiations to continue. So I think all they're doing is just really trying to press for a measured process. But we have the 14th of February consideration coming up by the Security Council, Blix and Mohamed Al-Baradei report then. And if absolutely nothing has changed, I think it would be not too difficult to get the Council to agree to a resolution that says Iraq is in material breach. I'm just trying to think of ways to avoid having a conflict. And if there was a united voice was sent to Baghdad saying, you are in material breach, and that was, you know, and it stopped there. I'm oversimplifying it greatly, and there might be a few other things on it. I think that might even bring about a change and could be some help towards avoiding an armed conflict. But I'm afraid we have to be ready for it.
And yet, Gerard Baker, it has seemed up to this point that a number of European nations don't want to say exactly that because they're afraid if they give Washington carte blanche, it will definitely take it, that Washington's just looking for the open space to go to war.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's so many kind of games of bluff and double bluff being played here, as Terence rightly points out. Part of the whole strategy so far, and part of the reason, to be honest, why the French and the German performance last week was so unhelpful, was that it was the aim of the U.S. and Britain, and indeed of the U.N., and in backing unanimously the Security Council resolution back in November, was to increase the pressure on Saddam and make it absolutely clear to him that the international community, the U.N., was not going to tolerate any more prevarication, was not going to tolerate any more of this cheat and retreat, and that this was really his last chance to do this, to cooperate. He had to come forward and do it. Otherwise, he would be, if he wouldn't disarm himself, he would be disarmed in a war. Now, as I say, and that's why the French and the German German intervention last week was so unhelpful, because it absolutely gave the impression to Saddam that, yeah, and certainly the remarks that were made by French and German officials suggested that they're quite happy to let inspections go on and on and on forever. And of course, we know that Saddam is brilliant at that game, and he can simply just continue with it, let the inspections go on and not conduct any kind of serious disarmament himself, and, you know, avoid the risk of facing a military conflict. And that was, I know that's why U.S. officials were, and British officials were so outraged by the remarks by the French and the Germans last week, that they have actually not helped the process itself. They have actually probably, ironically, made war more likely by actually making Saddam fall for the miscalculation that he can get away with this.
And yet, Jack Beattie, over the weekend, in that vein, all the U.S. officials stepped up and said, hey, we're not going to be slowed down by this kind of resistance from France and Germany. We will do the necessary. Do you see any serious handbrake still waiting to be grabbed that would veer toward peace, not war?
I don't, but I want to return to a question of our credibility. Central to this whole matter is our claim that there is lots of hidden weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Well, then the question is, how has our credibility been about claims that inspectors have been able to look into thus far? And if our credibility has not held up about those claims that the inspectors have been able to investigate now, what grounds do we have to suppose that our claims about these other matters are true? For example, in his speech to the UN, Mr. Bush said, and I quote, Saddam has had numerous meetings with Iraqi nuclear scientists, a group he has called nuclear mujahideen, his holy nuclear warriors. Well, the BBC transcript, according to the report today, the BBC transcript of that speech of Saddam, which was made in 2000, does not speak of nuclear mujahideen. It says nuclear energy mujahideen, and it does not mention weapons. Now, that's the kind of thing that is in this report I alluded to again and again and again. Now, yes, we know Iraq is not credible, but just how credible is the United States? How credible is Mr. Bush when in his UN speech he asserts that there were al-Qaeda in Baghdad being treated at a hospital, and then the Wall Street Journal reports that just as soon as Jordan demanded the extradition of a wounded al-Qaeda member, he was flung out of the country.
Terrence Taylor, pick up some of this. You hear the points that Jack is conveying to us. At the same time, we heard Hans Blix talking today about 1,000 tons of VX nerve agent, about enough biological medium to produce 5,000 liters of concentrated anthrax. So do we have, to your view, legitimate claims and fears here, or a bunch of hokum?
We have absolutely legitimate claims here, and I think what was very striking to me today, that Dr. Hans Blix actually confirmed that. He, in part of his statement, he said he confirmed the assessment of UNSCOM on all the outstanding issues on the biological and chemical weapons issues and the prohibited missile programs. He said he also confirmed the assessment of the so-called Amarin panel. That was an independent panel led by Ambassador Amarin, which examined independently with experts, not UNSCOM or UN Special Commission experts, but people from outside who came in, looked at all the evidence, and they said, yes, here are all the outstanding issues. And Dr. Blix mentioned most of them today, and he was very specific about quantities and so on. And as someone myself, we've been very close to it. I think we must not be distracted by the rhetoric of political leaders and measure it by that standard. Measure it by the hard facts and very worrying evidence, in the mountain of evidence that the UN Special Commission has provided and the International Atomic Energy Agency has as well. For example, on the nuclear side, Mohammed El-Baradei said today that Iraqis have failed to supply information on weapons design. Now, as a commissioner, this was one thing with an overview of all the weapons programs that we never found any weapons components of a nuclear weapon, the electrical firing circuit, the explosive lenses. We did find the special high-explosive, so-called HMX. And on that, I was alarmed to hear Mohammed El-Baradei report that some of that had disappeared, which we had impounded and kept under observation. Now he reports that inspectors found that a large quantity of that has disappeared. Mm. So there is very hard evidence, and I think if you look, and which is public available, a lot of it, and we need to look at the right bit of evidence, reports by the UN and things like that, and listen to Dr. Blix.
And around we go. Terrence Taylor, Gerard Baker, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Martin Indyk. He's former U.S. ambassador to Israel, two terms, 95 to 97, and 2000-2001, former Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, 97 to 2000, and current director of the Savan Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Good evening and welcome, Martin Indyk.
Good evening.
Thank you for joining us. You've written today in the New York Times about President Bush avoiding what you call the inspections trap. With Hans Blix's statement today, is the U.S. deeper in or less ensnared in what in this inspections trap you describe?
Well, it's still in the inspections trap, but it now has a way out as a result of this blistering report, if you'll excuse me. The way out is, I think, fairly straightforward. What Blix has done is catalog all the things that Iraq has not come clean on in a very detailed way, as your previous panelists have suggested. I think that what the administration should now do is go to the Security Council and say to them, what we need now is an ultimatum to Iraq, that they should have, whatever, 1 week, 2 weeks, to come clean with all of the questions, answer all of the questions that Blix has now put forward about their VX, about their chemical munitions, about their anthrax, about their missiles, and force the issue.
Is 1 week a reasonable period of time, or is it a narrow window guaranteed to produce failure?
It can be 2 weeks. It can be 3 weeks. It shouldn't be any longer than that. They don't need more time than that. But that would then put the onus on Iraq to do what it has avoided doing up to now. What it's been doing, as you've already discussed, is cooperating, opening the doors, making it look as if they are cooperating with UNMAFIC.
Just turning their pockets inside out as fast as they could.
Right, but that's not the same as complying with the disarmament requirements of the resolutions. Disarming means bringing forward the things that we know they're hiding, as opposed to the things we don't know they're hiding.
Can you imagine the Security Council, Martin Indyk, being prepared to stand up without veto and demand this ultimatum, make this ultimatum, I should say?
Well, I think that we have a very good case for it, and if they're not prepared to do that, then I think we expose the members of the Security Council that they're not serious about implementing their resolutions. But Blix has set the administration up perfectly for this kind of effort, because he's laid out all the things that they have not accounted for very specifically, and therefore they have one chance. Come clean at least on these things.
Gerard Baker, can you imagine Europeans standing by the United States making that ultimatum? You've got 1, 2, 3 weeks, Iraq, here it is.
The timing is obviously going to be a subject for negotiation, as ever with these things. Once you get into this process, the French will say they want 6 weeks, and the Americans will say, no, we want 2 weeks. You know, there may be a time period, but I can imagine. I mean, as Martin Indyk says, that the Blix case set out today was very strong, and talking to European officials today, in reaction, there was actually even some, I detected a measure of some surprise, actually, at how strong the Blix statement, the Blix report was, and a little bit of surprise, I think, at how blunt and clear and detailed and extensive it was in lining up exactly where Saddam Hussein has failed to comply so far. So, and to be really honest, if you go back to Resolution 1441, it requires Saddam Hussein to cooperate, and it's pretty clear that both in terms of the declaration that he issued, which was full of holes and actually meaningless in many respects, and the second part of 1441, which requires him to cooperate, in both those terms, he has not complied with Resolution 1441. Now, all the Europeans have said today is, oh, the inspectors must be given more time. Well, you know, there is a legitimate question. How much time do you need to know whether or not this man intends to comply? And I think the chances are pretty good that if the US and Britain can spell out, you know, exactly, and indeed using the Blix report, spell out how he needs to comply, what he needs to do
and
to
on
comply,
a tight deadline,
Europeans will accept it.
Excuse me, Gerard Baker, we've got to take a break here. Martin Indyk, former U.S. ambassador to Israel, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can join us as well. Bush Blix has spoken. Are you ready for war or for more inspections? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the UN Weapons Inspectors Report and the prospects for war. Mohamed El-Baradei, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, reported to the Security Council that his inspectors had found no evidence of an Iraqi nuclear weapons program. He also put forth today's most direct plea for continued inspections.
Our work is steadily progressing and should be allowed to run its natural course. With our verification system now in place, barring exceptional circumstances, and provided there is a sustained proactive cooperation by Iraq, we should be able, within the next few months, to provide credible assurance that Iraq has no nuclear weapon program. These few months, in my view, would be a valuable investment in peace because they could help us avoid a war.
Mohamed El-Baradei delivering his report to the UN Security Council earlier today. Are you ready for war or for more inspections? Should the U.S. proceed to war without a UN blessing? Is the U.S. too eager for war or Europe too hesitant? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests are Gerard Baker, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, and Terrence Taylor, Executive Director of the U.S. Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies and a former Chief UN Weapons Inspector in Iraq. Don's calling from Franklin, Massachusetts. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You've got some great guests, and of course, we're hearing some of the viewpoints that over the last few months have been traditionally part of the propaganda that our administration has put out.
You're chalking it all up to propaganda, Don.
Yes, well, the American people are realizing that the threat has been exaggerated from Iraq, from Saddam Hussein. The inspectors have found no corroborating evidence at all for anything the administration has told us. We've been given a series of lies from the Bush administration, starting with those tubes that were supposed to be for nuclear enrichment. They turned out to be rocket tubes. They told us, as one of your guests mentioned, about the Iraqi who was taking refuge. I'm sorry, the Al-Qaeda who was taking refuge in Iraq. That turned out to be a false story. All for the last 6 months, we've got false stories, false stories, false stories.
But, Don, what about the 1,000 tons of VX nerve agent that Hans Blix said today is still missing? What about this medium enough to produce 5,000 liters of concentrated anthrax? At this point, does that all look like propaganda to you? Or is the UN weapons inspector talking. Does he not have your trust at all?
No, certainly he does. If he can explain how a growth medium, like I'm assuming he's talking about agar, which you can grow penicillin on or anything else like that, we're taking the administration's word on what those 12,000 pages mm-hmm. said as far as the declaration. Saddam Hussein now has, if he comes forth with anything else that's there, then he's in violation of that declaration. If that declaration is wrong, then the administration owes it to the American people to give us one shred of evidence. Where are our CIA operatives? They're operating freely in the country now, scouting mm-hmm. bombing sites mm-hmm. for when we start killing. But why can't they find a single scrap of evidence that they can tell the American people, that Bush can tell the American people, here's what we found?
Don, it's we've got the question, and thank you for raising it. Jack Beatty, here's the resonant chord that you were hitting earlier. Americans increasingly skeptical about this war, and Don saying, I haven't seen the evidence that persuades me.
Yes, and you know, if the question is, where is the imminent threat? And I heard nothing today about an imminent threat. Is the imminent threat in the inoperative nuclear plants? Is the imminent threat in the nitric acid plant that's the inspector said is they inspected and found nothing? Is it from the tubes that we now know are not the tubes? Is it from the import of the attempt to get uranium when some people think that attempt goes back to the 80s? Where is the imminent threat that this matter will bring to us? And according to the Wall Street Journal today, the president even has the fanciful idea that the Iraqis are going to import somehow, bring drones into the United States or have them made here and use the drones to have gas on the American people. They're going to bring drones into the United States?
Well, sometimes these days, Jack, I don't know what's fanciful anymore. But Terrence Taylor, Don's our listener, is casting a very skeptical light on your assertions that there are real and dangerous weapons of mass destruction, or at least the fixings for those in Iraq. Is his skepticism justified in your view?
It's not, but I can understand why people raise these points, and they need to be convinced. And I don't think there's been some terribly good explanations on having all the data laid out.
Why not more firm, hard evidence? Is it just there?
The evidence is there, of course. And let me make clear that I'm speaking from, my personal point of view. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking as an international civil servant at the time I was doing all these things in Iraq. I'm not an inspector, and I'm not working for any government at all, and I wasn't at that time either. Only for the UN. I've been very close to this, and having looked at the evidence, hard evidence, quantities of material that have been imported into Iraq, which has not been explained, there's pretty clear to me that they have ready-to-use biological weapons and ready-to-use chemical weapons.
So why do you think Washington is not laying out firmer evidence if they're now facing what we're hearing called by Tom Daschle today a credibility gap? Of course, there may be some cost to their intelligence, but if they need global credibility to go to war as they seem to want to, why not put more evidence on the table?
Well, it's hard to think of what more you might need. Don't forget where the onus lies. It lies on Iraq to show and tell. And the Iraqis have been playing this very well all along. They have not fulfilled that obligation at all. And we spent years in the 1990s trying to uncover these programs, and eventually we did by following trails of material and forcing admissions from them. But they only make minimal declarations. They don't tell us, as Dr. Blix said today, how much quantities of anthrax they produced for weapons purposes. They've hidden that information.
Let's try and get one more call. Frank's on the line. Welcome, Frank. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's an interesting discussion, but it all plays into Bush's rhetoric about the threat in the first place. Isn't it conceivable that the threat of Saddam being out of power and having vast sums of money and allegiance from special guards and connections throughout the whole world, which is getting smaller all the time, more of a threat than any credible...
Well, Frank, you're imagining Saddam Hussein up in a cave with Osama bin Laden and lots of money cell phones?
That's foolish. But I can certainly imagine him taking other avenues to thwart our country. And as I recall, his son just recently said that 9/11 was a picnic. Anthrax came into our country, and that's the most most credible threat I've heard so far to our stability.
Frank, we've got our time's running down. I want to put it to Gerard Baker. Gerard, can you imagine that if the hammer does fall here, that Saddam Hussein, either in his person or in his legacy, poses an even greater threat on the other side of war?
No. He's in charge at the moment of a regime, which is a repressive regime, which has its hands on all the levers of power in Iraq and all the material that it needs to conduct warfare internationally and indeed to repress its own people. It's very different when he's out of power. And just one final thing on what people have said. Terrence is exactly right. The onus is on Saddam. It is not on on the British and the Americans to produce their intelligence. The critical thing people have to ask themselves is, Saddam Hussein has been in power for more than 20 years, has made a specific objective of developing weapons of mass destruction throughout that entire period. Does anybody seriously believe, why would anybody seriously believe that this man would not have weapons of mass destruction?
But why would a superpower who needs credibility not step up and deliver more evidence when there's so much doubting going on?
Well, much evidence has been produced. And, you know, what Hans Blix produced today, some of, you know, the origins of which, some of which come from intelligence, but most of it comes from the inspectors themselves. What they know is that there is tons and tons of this material unaccounted for, and warheads and documentation relating to all this, which is completely unaccounted
for. Gerard Baker, our time is almost up. In a word, are we closer to war after the Hans Blix report or not?
Yes, we are. I think we are.
And Terence Taylor, your view?
Sadly, I think we are. Some strategic decisions have to be taken in Baghdad to make things change.
And with that, we're out of time. Terence Taylor, joining us from Washington, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Terence Taylor is Executive Director of the U.S. Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies and a former Chief Inspector with the U.N. Weapons Inspections in Iraq. And Gerard Baker in Washington, thank you to you for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Gerard Baker is Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, Saddam's 1988 chemical attack continues to haunt the Kurds. This is On Point. When laying out the case for disarming Saddam Hussein, President Bush frequently points out that the Iraqi dictator is the only world leader who has used weapons of mass destruction on his own people. That occurred in March of 1988 when a mix of mustard gas, nerve gas, and cyanide was unleashed on the Kurdish city of Halabja. 5,000 Kurds perished, thousands more suffered disfiguring injuries. Kurdish-American filmmaker Jano Rozibiani went back to his native land to document the story of the Kurds and their suffering. The result, a docudrama titled Gian, was screened at the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival in Boston this past weekend. In this radio diary, Rose Abiani says making the film was painful but rewarding.
One point I gathered a couple hundred people and I told them I'm here to make a film about them, to take their stories to the outside world. And what will never leave me or leave my memory was what they did. And that was just staring at me in silence, tears coming down their eyes. And every time I screen the film at a festival or anywhere in the world, I can't help but remember that moment. And it does make me feel good to know that I was able to deliver upon my promise. The people, everybody looks twice their age. Some of the examples that I saw during my research that I wished to put in the film and I could not. For instance, I had a girl, 18-year-old girl. Tears would come out of her eyes. And the minute they would come out, they would solidify and they would turn into crystal. And you could put them on a rock and hit it with a hammer. It will not break. And she's still living. And I wanted to even put her in the film, but then I felt maybe I'm exploiting her. There were so many stories to tell, especially stories during the actual attack that people were telling me were just mind-boggling. And if I could put all of that in film, I need many, many more minutes. This film's only 94 minutes, and I could use another 10,000 minutes to tell all their stories. The Kurds, in most cases, have been trivialized. While Saddam was doing the Anfal on the Kurds, and there was no mission beyond that, just a typical condemnation that didn't really help much, but the next thing Saddam does a mistake and he goes into Kuwait, the population of which is less than the number of Kurds killed in the genocide Anfal campaign. Yet it became, Saddam overnight became such an evil monster that he must be stopped. And the whole world was convinced to go and attack him and kick him out of Kuwait. The problem is if the Kurds had the oil, their own oil, their own resources in their own hands, they would have been as important as Kuwait or any other nation that's been getting more sound or more news or more attention. There's a famous Kurdish saying, Kurds have no friends but the mountains. And that has very much been true. And every time someone from the outside have come to help the Kurds or rescue the Kurds, it turned out they've only used them for their own ends. And that's what they're worried about even now. What they're worried about is what happens if Saddam is removed. can the Kurds benefit and live like the rest of human beings, or would they be used again and then end up with the short end of the stick again? This is the fourth festival I've been to in the United States, and both in America and in the United Kingdom. People have walked out at the end of the film and told me that up to this point they were against attacking Saddam, but now that they've seen this film, they're 100% for it. That's basically the reaction that I get from so many people. Also, I may add that to my surprise, a great many people had never heard of the chemical attacks on the Kurds, or if they had heard, they didn't know the extent of it. And so to me, that was, you know, important information to deliver to them.
Gianno Rosabiani is director of the film Gian. The docudrama is being screened at film festivals around the world over the next several months. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Greg.